Right, we are today starting a new series. I've been recently doing one on how to study the Bible, which I'll return to later, but I'm starting today a series which comes from my book 6, and that has to do with how to identify and handle wicked people. Now that book should be coming out later this year. I'm just in the finishing off stages of it at the moment and going through editing it and polishing it and so on. But it's turned into a very big book, much bigger than I expected it ever to be. It's getting on for nearly 700 pages, so I'm having to try and shorten it where I can. What I've tried to do, I mean, I've left out lots of things I could have put in, but I've tried to include lots of different angles on this whole subject of dealing with the wicked. And I've tried to do so in part because it's a subject that just isn't discussed. No one ever deals with it. I've never in my whole life heard a sermon on it. I've never read a book on it. I've never heard anybody give me any practical advice on it, ever, ever at all. And I've never met anybody who has. So it's a subject that, so far as I'm aware, just isn't discussed or dealt with in any practical or even in any theological sense. It's just a subject that's not dealt with. So there's a lot of stuff there, and I've had to start always from complete zero knowledge and explain everything, because it's something people are coming to with no previous teaching on the subject. So, what I'm going to be doing today is an introduction to this whole subject, but you'll need to bear with me because this is a very big subject, and the whole book I've done on it is in 27 chapters, and it goes through all sorts of different aspects of this problem, like an MRI scan, really. I'm looking at it from lots of different perspectives. And so today I'm going to begin by looking at some introductory concepts about what do I even mean by the wicked? Who are they? How do we? And we're going to look at how to identify them, which we'll carry on with in the next teaching day. But then we're going to go on to look at all sorts of things to do with wickedness and wicked people in the workplace, and also how to identify deceivers and the damage that deception causes, and also a series of chapters on the subject of the wicked within churches, and in particular amongst church leaders. Again, for obvious reasons, that's not a subject that church leaders ever teach on, and therefore there's just no teaching background to any of this. So I'm going to do quite a lot on that, and then in the later stages we'll look at our duty to resist the wicked, how far we can go in resisting the wicked, the importance of courage in resisting the wicked, and also I'm going to look at another subject that nobody ever talks about, and that's imprecatory prayer or imprecation or execration, in particular the Psalms of David that deal with this. But by no means is he the only person in the Bible that deals with that. It's a subject again that nobody ever talks about, and I'm going to go through that in some detail, and then I shall finish the whole series looking at the subject of witchcraft and curses and the occult and things like that, and the impact that that has and the role that that plays within this broad subject of the wicked. So the wicked is our umbrella theme, and it has many, many different aspects there too, which I'll be looking at. So bear with me, because I won't be able to deal with everything today or cover everything. There'll be lots of issues that we've got to deal with in later days. So the other point I would make is I'm going to be trying to cram a lot in today, and I won't be giving all the Bible references that I give in the book. So if you want the detail of the theological undergirding of what I'm saying, the Bible references, those will be found in the book, because it would take far too long for me to read them all out, because what I tend to do is I tend to overprove things, especially when I'm dealing with contentious or little known areas that are little discussed. And rather than giving one proof and being accused of relying on a verse, I tend to give 6 or 7, or even more, in order to demonstrate that I'm not relying on a single little verse here or there. So get the book and look at that for much more detail. So the book is more detailed than what I'll be doing today and in future teaching days, and the book is needed in addition to this. It's not really a substitute for it. So, let me just begin now to introduce this. I've personally never seen any book, as I that deals with how to identify or handle the wicked, or even that really talks about the wicked. 20 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it possible if someone had said to me that one day I would write a book on this subject, because at that time I knew very little about the wicked and had no idea at all that they were so numerous, or really what they really were. And in particular, I had never imagined that there were so many wicked people inside churches. That has been a profound discovery to me, which I would never have imagined. So when I started out as a Christian, I was extremely naive. I remember an acting inspector when I started in the police force who told me that I was unbelievably naive. Well, I think he was right. But I was probably no more naive than most Christians are, probably at or about the same level of naivety. But at that time, I failed even to recognize the wicked, let alone how to handle them. But over the last sort of 3 decades or more, God has put me through a training program whereby he's brought me into contact with, I think, more than my fair share statistically of wicked people. Firstly, I began as a police constable for 3 years, and then I went back to being a lawyer again, and went into the law as a solicitor and spent about 25 years or so doing that. And I was involved in litigation, which is more of the muck and bullets sort of side of law, fighting with people, really. And you tend to see a lot in that. I dealt with a lot of employment law, too, where you see people at their ugliest, on both sides often. But more importantly, perhaps than any of those things, I became an employer. So I set up my own law firm, and at its peak, that had over 80 staff. And if you've got 80 staff, you've always got a headache. You've always got someone who's being a complete migraine to you. It'd be virtually impossible not to, unless you were exceptionally wise, which I was not, in how you recruit. At that time, I was far from exceptionally wise, exceptionally unwise in how I recruited. And God allowed me to go through this, and I used to scratch my head and wonder, why am I going through all this? Why am I having all this opposition? And I think one of the reasons for it, well, one reason was it was the natural consequence of my lack of wisdom, and therefore it was the inevitable result of not being wise. But I think secondly, God was bringing it about because he wanted me to learn about this subject, and he knew that I would never learn about it in churches because it's never discussed, and I'd never be able to read about it because nobody writes about it. The only way to learn about this was to go through umpteen experiences, and you can't learn these things just by one or two battles. You learn it through battle after battle after battle, whereby you begin to notice the patterns. You see where the dots are forming into patterns, and you see things that come up again and again and again, and you start to notice trends and themes and patterns, and you realize there's a scheme to this, there's a pattern to this. And I think that's what God did, and he made me go through those things. But as I mentioned, the greatest shock to me was just how much wickedness there is within churches. And I'm going to go on in this series to explain why I say that and what I mean by it. Because I think one of the biggest problems you've got to overcome in this whole subject of the wicked, it's a definition problem. All our definitions are either inadequate or mistaken, and or non-existent. We don't have definitions. And I want to try to recalibrate our definitions on so many different things, whereby we begin to look at things with a more accurate understanding of what words mean, what the facts are, what the situations are. And when I was going through some of these things initially and seeing what was happening in churches, especially amongst leaders, I thought, I must be imagining this. It can't be that there is such godlessness and such wickedness and dishonesty and malice and manipulation and so much evil in the way that people operate, even amongst leaders. But actually, far from imagining it or exaggerating, I think I was underestimating it, and I think I'm still understating it even now, because I'm naturally drawn to being cautious, because my whole life has been based on evidence gathering and forensically analysing things. So I'm not naturally drawn to hyperbole and exaggeration. I tend to understate. But what I'm saying is, ironically, even at its understated level, the position is shocking as to what's happening within the churches and just generally. And I shall go on later today to look a little bit more at the stats and numbers of this and attempt to try to give us some sense of proportion as to how big a problem is this. So, in the book and in the talks I'm going to give, I shall give real life examples of situations I've faced, because I've faced loads of them, and I haven't by any stretch put them all in the book, otherwise I really would have tried your patience. But those which I have given are real life situations. The facts are all true. All I've done is change the names, so that the pretty much all the names used in this book are names of people I've never met. So I've never known a Mavis, and I've never known, I've always used names of people I've never met. So all the names are false, but the facts are correct. And I wish that someone had put this book into my hands 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago. It could have saved me from so many expensive and painful learning experiences where I had to learn. I've had to learn everything through pain, and it's so much easier to learn through advice. And I wish I'd been able to have this book, but I hadn't got it. It didn't exist as far as I'm aware. But it would have prevented so many misjudgments and so many errors and so many tricks that I fell for. So I can't claim that this book or this teaching series is going to address every issue you'll face and will identify the characteristics of every villain that you come across. Because you'll have your own Mavises and your own whoevers in your life. And they'll have their own particular little facts and features and schemes and systems. But what I am confident can be done is that we can establish some general principles and methodology and technique. And what we can do is shift the odds in your favour. So instead of wandering about like an absolute innocent know-nothing, like I used to be, and like I think most people are, with no real discernment about what's going on, you can have more discernment. You won't end up with total perfect discernment. I don't know that anybody's got that. But what you can have is more discernment. You can make it harder for people to trick you. You can make it so that you identify them quicker. Their deception is exposed earlier, and the spread thereof is contained. And that's a big, big advantage. Another objective that I have in doing this is to seek to persuade you that the numbers of the wicked are vastly bigger than you probably think they are, and that their impact is much greater than you probably think it is. And even in churches, I say even, I think especially, I should use the word especially. I think the wickedness in churches is the most important place where wickedness is, because the church is the most important place. And therefore, wickedness within it is inherently more serious than wickedness somewhere else. But also, the part of the problem is that the unbiblical structure of traditional churches with hierarchy and clergymen who are paid, who have large churches with large audiences all sitting in a row where they do nothing, the clergyman does everything, everyone defers to him, or even in many cases feels that they're supposedly obliged to obey him and so forth. All of that compounds the problem, because what God set up was a system within the church whereby wickedness amongst leaders would be exposed and be difficult to maintain and persist in. But what's been brought about instead over the centuries is we've established churches on a basis which is the exact opposite of the way they were in the New Testament. So the whole system that God set up, with small churches, with unpaid local elders, and with everybody active, everybody doing things, everybody knowing everybody, and various other things too, makes it difficult for the wicked to flourish and remain. It becomes, the churches are meant to be like chlorine foot baths. And so the wicked go into that chlorine foot bath, like a verruca into a chlorine foot bath. It's an inhospitable environment for them. Instead, what we have is churches which support and maintain and help the wicked to flourish, because they're not biblical. Now, I deal with that in my book 8, which is at a reasonably advanced stage, and that'll be coming out hopefully later this year or early next year. And that's all about the whole business of church structure and hierarchy and unbiblical church methodology. But I would say it's probably within the leadership of churches that the highest proportion of wicked Christians are to be found, if we speak in proportionate terms. And wolves and hirelings, they get to the top and they stay at the top because of the absence of biblical safeguards. And such men, clergymen I call them with inverted commas, clergy-minded, they believe that they are above God's people and entitled to rule over God's people. And they may not use the word rule, but they believe in their hearts they are entitled to rule. And some would even use that word. And they're authoritarian and controlling and manipulative, and they use people and they feel entitled to deceive people if that will assist their agenda. Because their agenda in their own mind is equated to God's will. Or God's will is equated to their agenda. So anything which is consistent with their agenda is consistent with God's will, insofar as they examine the ethics of it at all, which they may not. But if they do, they quickly assume that their own interest is equal to God's interest. So, if your discernment begins to grow, and that's partly what we're trying to do here, to grow in discernment, the minute your discernment begins to grow, the wicked will notice. Now, hitherto, the wicked have been getting on with it and you've been oblivious to them. You don't even know they are wicked. You don't know what they're doing. You don't know how they're doing it. You don't know why they're doing it. You don't even know that they're doing it. But the minute you begin to grow some discernment, they will notice. They'll notice the change in you far more quickly than you'll notice anything in them. And as you begin to grow in discernment, people will begin to move to silence you, to marginalize you, to attack you. And they'll do that in workplaces and they'll do it in churches. So you need to be aware of that, because any increase in your discernment is a threat to their position. So we've got to begin to learn how to defend ourselves and how to act properly. But the problem is that we can't just do anything we want in response. We're answerable not only for how we act, but for how we react. And we've got to do what is right and react in a godly way, even when we're threatened. And we can't just do as we wish. We need to operate in self-control. So that makes the problem more difficult, because we've got to defend ourselves whilst not being like the wicked. That is really difficult. So another thing I want to try to bring across in this series is that you have a duty to stop being naive. The Bible speaks of this group called the simple or the naive. And indeed, the first 7 or 8 chapters of Proverbs are devoted pretty much to telling you over and over and over and over and over and over again to stop being naive. Now, the question is, could it be that what God is saying in those chapters is that he wants us to stop being naive? It occurs to me that that could be why he keeps saying it. And so the fact that he does keep saying it in that way, more so than he says many other things, indicates the importance of this, but also it indicates that many of us are naive. So that is my proposition to you, that I think many of you are naive. And I have in support the fact that God seems to think that. Hence, he keeps telling us to stop being. He wouldn't tell us to stop being if he didn't think we were. So we have got to stop being naive and become wise, become discerning. And yet, Jesus complicates it a little, because we've got to be as wise as serpents, but as innocent as doves. And that's a difficult combination of objectives. You see, it's not good enough to be as wise as a serpent and as innocent as a serpent. That's what the wicked are. Neither is it any good being as innocent as a dove and as wise as a dove. That's what most of us are. What we've got to be is that apparently pair of opposites. As wise as a serpent and as innocent as a dove. That is why we need to learn, and that's why it takes time. Because you've got to be shrewd and understanding and discerning and have knowledge about what other people do and how they do it and why they do it without doing it, without being like them. That's hard. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is to help us to learn how to react to dealing with the wicked without being like them. And I think we live, one of the theme I want to bring over is we live in a time in history which is, I believe, probably the most wicked time in world history to date. And I think I say that knowing that the Bible speaks of the time of the flood. Now, the time of the flood, God wiped out everybody except 8 people. Now you'd think, well, surely this is now where you're moving into hyperbole, because if you're saying this world now is more wicked than the time of the flood, then surely you are departing from reason. Well, I'll hopefully be able to establish that. That is at least my belief. And when you look at the hugeness of the apostasy within the church, the mental chaos within the world, family breakdown, marriage breakdown, when you look at abortion on an industrial scale, pornography, gambling on a massive scale, pornography on a kind of vast scale, and the utter corruption of young people, the way that they're being corrupted by the media, the deception of the media, all sorts of things happening which are unprecedented. They didn't have abortion, as far as I know, at the time of the flood. There are lots of things that we do today, even that are being done by supposed Christians, that weren't even done at the time of the flood. So on that basis, I make that claim, which I hope to substantiate. So let me then press on. So in looking at this question of who and what are the wicked, a big mistake is to assume that the wicked are all exceptional people like Hitler and Stalin. In many of our minds, there is this assumption. The wicked are sort of outrageously strange and weird people who just do amazingly big and vast things, murdering millions of people. That's the wicked. And for many of us, that's what we think. I want to challenge that. If the problem was people like Hitler and Stalin, if they were the problem, we wouldn't have much of a problem, because none of us would ever meet them. Every now and again we'd have to have a war or something, but most of the time none of us at our level would have any need to have any understanding of the wicked, because we'd never come across them. That's not the position. The wicked are alarmingly plentiful and very, very ordinary. They are all around us, they work with us, they live alongside us, they look totally normal, they sound normal, they're in our churches. What distinguishes the wicked is that they have hard hearts, that they're false, that they're devious, that they're selfish, and above all, that they're manipulative and malicious. And that is what we're talking about. Now, you don't need to be Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot to do those things. Those things are done by ordinary folk who live next to you and are in your church and are in your workplace. So an early indication we get in the Bible of how wickedness is defined is with Potiphar's wife, the account of Joseph. And she tries to commit adultery with Joseph. And Joseph says that to do that would be great wickedness. Now, if committing adultery with Potiphar's wife would be, speech marks, great wickedness, then what would be the things that are happening all around us? Abortion, pornography and homosexuality, gender confusion, militant Islam, lies being systematically told by our leaders and by our media on an industrial scale. Are those not wickedness? I would say that they are. But also manipulation within the church and corruption within the church is wickedness. And so King David didn't think that the wicked were few in number. He said, "More in number than the hairs of my head are those who hate me without cause." And that again is one of the features of the wicked, is that they hate real Christians, they hate Christianity, they hate the gospel. And the more godly you are, the more they hate that. And if ever you see that irrational or apparently irrational hate towards a Christian, the person who's exhibiting it, I think is worthy of being classified as wicked. It's one of the features that they have. But anyway, if what Potiphar's wife wanted to do was great wickedness, what does that say about our society, in which so many things, even paedophilia, are now commonplace? People are even beginning now, you know, to attempt to construct a justification for paedophilia at an academic level. Academics are already beginning to publish papers saying that paedophilia is legitimate in the West, not just within Islam, where it's there's no argument about it. They think it's perfectly all right. So, but I think that deception and manipulation are wickedness. But if that is correct, if I'm right in placing it within that category, well, then how many people does that make wicked? Because lying and cheating and making false accusations, like Potiphar's wife did with Joseph, are absolutely normal. It's completely normal to be a liar. And when I say that, I mean within workplaces and within churches by ordinary people. I don't mean criminals. You might think, well, the trouble with you is you've got a jaundiced look on life because you were 3 years as a policeman and then you spent 25 years suing people. So you've got a totally jaundiced view. I don't think so. I'm looking at workplaces, staff I've employed, people who I've acted for or against and what they did. And I'm looking at people in churches primarily. But I'm saying within those contexts, lying is normal. So let me give you one or two stories just to set some of the scene for what I mean by why I say it's ordinary. And I'm trying to go out of my way to talk about ordinary people. You are not going to come across any Hitlers in this book. Ordinary folk. Now, this is a story about a person I'm going to call Andrew. And he was training to be a teacher. He was in his PGCE year, postgraduate certificate in education. And he had to spend a number of weeks in a school teaching classes and being monitored. And he's allocated a mentor person to look after him. I'm going to call this lady Gladys. Now, Gladys didn't like Andrew for whatever reason. I don't know why. But the point is that she deliberately set out to try to cause him to fail his assessment. She wanted him to fail. And this is what she did. Now, she knew Andrew was nervous. And one particular day, an assessor was coming in from the university to assess him teaching a class. Now, on that day, he had taught other classes with no assessor. But an assessor was coming in. And there was a boy in this class who had severe autism. And he had to stick to his usual routine or he'd become agitated. Now, Gladys was a regular teacher at this school and knew the boy well. And she was fully aware of what would happen if he was forced to move to another seat. And so, what she did, just before the examiner entered the room, without saying anything to Andrew, just before the examiner entered the room, Gladys made that boy move seats. Now, she knew exactly what would happen when that was done. The boy protested, but she insisted on it. There was no earthly reason for it. She'd never done it before. There was no conceivable reason for doing it. And it caused chaos. And this boy then went into chaos mode and ruined the whole lesson. And the whole lesson became about this boy being in this chair. And the assessor knew nothing of this. So the assessor just walks in with World War III underway and looks at Andrew, the trainee teacher, presiding over this chaos, and not unnaturally attributes the blame to him. He can't handle a class and so forth, because you see, once the autistic boy started kicking off, others joined in, and the whole thing degenerated into chaos. Now later, Gladys made weasel-worded excuses for why she'd done this, but she really had no reason at all. It was deliberately to sabotage him. Now what I'm saying to you is, this is my point, the behaviour that she did is rightly classified as wickedness, because it was devious, vindictive and cruel, and it was a betrayal of trust. Now, she had the job of mentoring him. And so she wasn't invading Poland or doing anything like that, but she was an ordinary person that you might meet at any time. And probably on other days, Gladys wouldn't have done that. But the point is, she did it that day. Now, the wicked are ordinary people like Gladys. And if you don't think the wicked are ordinary, you won't recognize them. Because if you recognize them by carrying the fact that they wear a Nazi SS uniform and they have a peaked cap, and that's how you know them, then you're not going to notice, you're not going to see them. Because you've got in your mind's eye a picture of something on an epic scale that you might meet once every 20 years. You're not going to recognize them when they walk into your life, because you won't be looking in the right places or looking for the right things. We need to be looking at entirely ordinary people doing ordinary things, but they're doing it with malice, with deception, with deviousness, with manipulation. That's what we're looking for. So we've got to stop being naive. And King Solomon, lamented this, as I said, and commanded us to stop being naive, and spoke of what a problem it causes. And if you look at the book, you can see how I've set out a number of illustrations of that. So a sign that a person is naive is their inability even to grasp that so many other people are wicked, let alone to identify and resist them. And so if you do begin to notice some wicked people, if you do begin to notice that that's happening, and you're surprised by it, the fact that you're surprised is an indication that you're starting with a wrong assumption, that there's something rare about it. You know, it's like going out into your garden and seeing a blackbird and being totally surprised, as if you'd seen some kind of rare Arctic bird that's in the wrong place. You see, you shouldn't be surprised to see a blackbird or a starling or a sparrow. You should think that's quite normal. You should be expecting to see the wicked on a virtually daily basis. The question is not, do they exist? The question is, who are they amongst the people that you know? Nevertheless, the fact that you have spotted it is a good sign. It shows that you are at least beginning to realise that they do exist. And I think of a lady I met called Imelda. I'm giving her that name. And she was telling me one time about how amazed she was at how people can lie so easily. She was absolutely flabbergasted and astonished in this story she was telling me about how people can lie so easily. She was talking on that particular occasion about a church leader. Now, I had to smile because she sounded exactly like I used to sound when I was first beginning to realise this and how normal it is to be wicked. Imelda's story, I'll briefly tell it. She worked in a government department for about 30 years and she was good at her job. She was an exceptionally sincere person. And that's partly why she found it so amazing when she came against liars. And then she had this very good and honest boss that was her boss for many years. This boss then moved on and was replaced by someone whom I'll call Daphne, who was much younger. Now, Daphne was less experienced than Imelda. And she then moved in to manage that department in which Imelda worked. And she began to pick on Imelda and to find fault with her work and to victimise her on a more consistent, ongoing basis. She procured it, really, for Imelda to be put on a formal evaluation by the HR department, personnel department, and to be monitored. And she kept on criticising her work and also telling lies about her. She also manipulated the evaluation procedure and bullied the HR department into being more negative than they wished to be. Now, in the end, Imelda felt so worn down by it all. She was a lady sort of in her 50s. She got so worn down, she just stopped fighting it. And she accepted a formal written warning about her for her incompetence, even though there wasn't any. And shortly after that, she took early retirement. And this is the interesting thing. When that happened, as soon as she'd put in for early retirement, Daphne's whole mood altered. She went into a good mood and started being relaxed and friendly. And there was even a drinks reception one evening. And Daphne was at it, Imelda was at it, and Daphne was in a very good mood. And Imelda commented to me, she said that what she found amazing was that Daphne felt no guilt or shame at how she'd behaved. That was a mystery to Imelda. How could she feel no shame at what she'd done? Well, that's one of the features of the wicked. They don't feel shame. They feel no shame or embarrassment at things like that. Their conscience isn't actively working, or it's been switched off. It's been so seared. It's like where it's been branded by a hot iron. If you brand yourself on the arm with a hot iron, the nerves under that skin, if you get a really bad burn, it'll kill the nerves. And thereafter, that piece of skin on your arm will be sort of no feeling in it. Well, that's what happens to a person's conscience. So when you see someone who has no shame, you know that their conscience is seared. And that's a key sign that the person is wicked, if they don't have a conscience. If a person feels guilty about what they're doing, it's actually in many ways a good sign, because it indicates they're at the early stages only of degenerating. They still have a functioning conscience where they don't feel guilt or shame. As you see with the utter brazenness of people going around cross-dressing and flaunting their homosexual promiscuity and so on, you see there is no conscience there. And that's an indication. But anyway, the point was, I said to Imelda, I said, it was quite clear what was happening. Daphne felt threatened at having a person working for her who knew more about the department than she did, and who was under her but knew more. And Daphne was a novice in that particular department, and she felt threatened. And I said, what Daphne was doing was just managing you out. She was just it's called managing someone out, where you persecute them until they leave. So if you haven't got a basis for getting rid of them, you basically, you make the workplace so inhospitable to them that they'll just leave. And that's a very normal technique used by certain managers to get someone out. Now, Imelda had no understanding of this. She was as innocent as the day is long. She was just like Pinocchio skipping along to school with his lunchbox in his hand, and Mr. Wolf and Mr. Fox come along. She had no idea at all of what Daphne was or what Daphne was doing. And again, Daphne wasn't dressed in an SS uniform. She was just an ordinary looking person, totally normal. And so, why did Daphne do it? Well, firstly, she was insecure in her new supervisory role. Secondly, she didn't want a person below her who knew more than she did. And thirdly, perhaps the most important reason, she could see, because the wicked are discerning, Daphne could see that Imelda was exceptionally honest. Now you might think, well, that's a good thing, surely. No, it's not. Not if you're wicked. The wicked do not want exceptionally honest people working under them or for them or alongside them. They see that as a threat and as a potential hazard. They don't see it as a virtue. So a person who's exceptionally honest will come under attack from the wicked because you are a potential danger to them. You might report things, you might tell the truth about situations, and that's a threat to them. So a dishonest person won't want any honest people working with them or under them or alongside them. And they will drive them out. So it may sound irrational to you, but it's totally, absolutely straightforward to them. To the wicked, that's obvious. So the thing is, one issue that Imelda had, she couldn't understand why Daphne would become hostile for no apparent reason. She thought that Daphne was, you know, emotional or something, you know, had complex emotional problems. And I said, no. It was cool and calculating. Emotions didn't really come into it. It was just a piece of business that needed doing. And so a wicked person will simply, in a cool and calculating way, they'll do these things because they plan them, because they want to. So Daphne herself wasn't upset. She was just inventing things to drive out Imelda because she wanted that outcome. And once that had been achieved, there was no need to keep up that act anymore. So once Imelda had put her resignation in, there was no need to carry on the routine. She could just go back to normal and be friendly again. She'd achieved her objective. And so her antipathy was at the level of her will and not in her feelings. And her actions were planned, not spontaneous. She was planning it. The wicked plan, they plot, they scheme. They plan their actions in advance with malice aforethought. They don't simply respond spontaneously to immediate stimuli and do things like a pinball machine. They think and plan and plot. They lie in their beds making plans. That's what the wicked do. I'll tell you another story about a chap called Joshua. He was a school teacher in America. And he endured 10 years under a malicious, devious principal or headmaster, as we would call them in England. His story had a different ending. He wasn't driven out. He just endured it for 10 years. It was a much longer campaign of bullying. And unlike Imelda, he could see what was happening. So he could see what was happening and why it was happening. His problem was he didn't know what to do about it. So he had at least got enough understanding to see what was happening. But he didn't know how to defend himself. He just endured it and refused to resign. And everything the principal threw at him, he endured it. Every dirty trick you could think of. But he had such a stubborn streak in him, he refused to resign. He refused to leave the school. And the persecution just went to higher and higher levels. The headmaster, the principal, told lies about him, made bogus complaints, encouraged others to make bogus complaints. There were a whole series of disciplinary hearings at which trumped up charges would be brought. And each time Joshua was found guilty, and each time he refused to resign and refused to go. He was trying to break Joshua's spirit, and he refused to do it. And what they did eventually was they sent him to sit all day doing nothing at the offices of the school board, what they call the school's board for the county. And he was humiliated for month after month, just sitting at the school's board with no class to teach. And that's what the principal made him do. He still wouldn't give in. And eventually he had a kind of victory, you could call it. They reduced the age at which a school teacher could retire and gave him a pension when he was only 48. And he then went into ministry as an assistant pastor. But he said to me that he felt God used those 10 years of vicious personal attacks upon him to test him and develop his character. And I think there's truth in that. But I think it would have been better if Joshua had known better how to defend himself rather than just how to be a punchbag. Do you see? And so Joshua just kept on praying for God's help, and at least in the area of endurance, he received that. And in the end of it all, when he retired early at 48, one of the officials from the county education department came up to him and spoke to him privately. And she knew all about the campaign of dirty tricks. And she said to him, she said, "Well, you beat the system." And there was amazement in her voice because she knew how rarely that happened. Most people are broken by these things. So, here's another brief story about two wicked women who were responsible for a training day. And this is a story told to me by someone I'm calling Albert, and he worked in a major sector in the civil service. And there was a training day being conducted by two women. We'll call them Beryl and Catherine. And the course they presented was badly prepared, poor content, not well presented. And throughout the day, Albert and the other delegates on this course, it's a whole day training course, felt increasingly frustrated at having to sit through such low quality training. They knew it was the fault of Beryl and Catherine, and they were employed full time by the civil service to provide training. Now, on these training days, you're supposed to fill in these appraisal sheets to talk about the quality of the course, its content and presentation, and so on. And Albert suggested to the others that they tell the frank truth about how useless the course had been. Now, the point is, what Beryl and Catherine were going to do was to stand on looking over people's shoulders at the end of the day, watching them fill the forms in. So in order to preempt that, Albert suggested that they fill the forms in at the final tea break before Beryl and Catherine could be there, so they could do it on their own. So they filled them in more truthfully, giving low marks, and then went back in after the tea break and just handed in a great big pile of appraisal forms. So Beryl and Catherine had been caught out. So that was one way in which Albert was quite astute. He could see what was coming and he acted sensibly to contend with it. Now, during the day as well, he says that he was alerted by some of the things that Beryl and Catherine were saying, how devious they were and how manipulative they were. And they even spoke openly about it, about how they dealt with their husbands and how they got their way with their husbands by being manipulative. And they spoke proudly of this, as if this was a virtue or a quality on their part. They were clever, being able to manipulate their husbands. And I suppose it ties in with what I mentioned. Because the wicked are so shameless, they feel no shame at saying these things. So they'll openly often say things, because they don't see anything wrong with it. So that was another indicator of their nature. But then what happened is the point of the story. Many weeks later, Albert learned of what had happened after the training day. And these two ladies had gone to their managers to explain why they had a whole raft of critical appraisal forms. Because normally what they do is stand over people and watch them filling them in, so they get higher marks. And they both said to their managers that they had been disrupted that day. The whole day had been badly disrupted by one of the delegates. And they spoke about this young woman. I'll call her Deirdre. And she was a quiet, timid young lady who said nothing all day. She was very quiet and timid. But they both said to their managers that she had ruined the day by being argumentative, disruptive, and dysfunctional, and constantly interrupting them. So what they said was the direct opposite of what happened. So Deirdre was introverted and said next to nothing. Now the management, this is where they were weak and useless, took it at face value, and they began an investigation. Now Deirdre, but only Deirdre, was interviewed. and she denied all the allegations, but the evidence against her was consistent. It was coming from two lecturers who were both senior to her, and she was on the brink of losing her job. The only thing that prevented it was that she was unusually tenacious in denying it and defending herself, and inconsistently refusing to accept it. Now, that came as a surprise to Beryl and Catherine. I don't think they expected her to be so tenacious. They'd chosen her because she was weak and timid and quiet and wouldn't say boo to a goose. That's why they chose her, to make her take the blame. They thought she was the least likely to defend herself, and they were right about one thing. They were right also about how ineffective the inquiry would be. The managers investigating couldn't be bothered to go to the proper lengths to find out. They made no inquiries beyond talking to Deirdre. What they should have done is spoken to the other delegates. They never did, because they were weak and lazy and careless and indifferent themselves. In the end, they just left the whole thing unresolved, and it hung on her personnel file as an unproven accusation. Now, those senior managers were neglecting their duty. I would say that was wicked. They had a duty of care which they failed to carry out properly. And they should have properly investigated. But also, Deirdre should have had enough common sense to insist on other delegates being interviewed, or even to contact them herself, but she never did. And she didn't do that. But what I find most striking about this is that Beryl and Catherine felt able to make a completely invented accusation against a person who they knew was totally innocent. Because it wasn't a question of degree. It wasn't that Deirdre's interruptions and heckling had been excessive. Her interruptions and heckling had never happened. They were completely invented. And they did it purely to improve their own position. Now, that requires a cold, calculating, heartless person. But my submission to you is that there are many such people. And so, what's shocking in a sense is that one of them must have been the first to say, let's say that Deirdre disrupted the lessons all day, then we won't be blamed. And the one who said that must have said it to the other, knowing that the other knew that to be false, but they had the willingness to say it. And that, I'm saying to you, is shocking. But it's totally normal. It's normal to act in that way. There's nothing remarkable about it. The only reason that I or you might be shocked is because I and you don't have an adequate appreciation of the normality of being like that. We think it's odd. So, why are the wicked so effective at identifying the naive and gullible? Because the naive and the simple can't easily identify the wicked, but the wicked can easily identify you. And the answer is they have a kind of natural shrewdness. I call it feral cunning. Feral as in pertaining to an animal, like a rat or a stoat has a kind of feral cunning. They operate in the flesh, and they're thoroughly worldly, and they're well tuned into this world system. So they are highly skilled in the art of self-preservation and self-promotion. Often that's their only real talent. They may be stupid in every other way, but they have this remarkable craftiness, and it's quite remarkable how much of it they have, in contradistinction to how much simple naivety we tend to have. They have the opposite in spades, in abundance. And I've had many staff in my time, whom I've employed, who are incapable of thinking intelligently or imaginatively on behalf of a client, but yet they could operate in that way to a very high level on their own behalf. They could do imaginative, creative, intelligent, clever things to defend themselves, but not to act for a client. Do you see? And so, craftiness, if you see that in a person, it's one of the distinguishing features of the wicked, and you can use it as one of your means of identifying them. And so, their ungodliness, their craft, gives them a competitive advantage over genuine believers. And so, in one sense, the less worldly we are, the less carnal we are, it puts us on an unlevel playing field. It gives them a competitive advantage over us, because it's as though when we have to go out into the world, we're always playing on the home ground, on the home stadium of the wicked. We're always playing where they're familiar, in their system, in their world, where the rules are the way they like them to be. And they're used to those familiar rules and values. And so it's like the dishonest manager that Jesus commended in Luke chapter 16. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And what Jesus is speaking about is our lack of shrewdness. And that's what they have, feral cunning and shrewdness. And so a simple but naive person is a sincere person, is like a tourist who's outside of his usual environment. That's how many of us are. We're like tourists in the world. And the wicked are at home. It's their native land. And we're like tourists amongst them. And they can see your lack of awareness. They can see your unfamiliarity with the rules of the battle. They can spot you. You stand out. But you don't spot them. They know what you are. You don't know what they are. So feral discernment, it operates in that direction. The wicked man knows your nature, but you don't know his. And that inequality gives him an advantage until you grow in maturity. And hence, the repeated instruction to us to grow in maturity. And that's why we need to set that as an objective. And my experience is, I don't think I've ever met anybody who's aiming to become wise, aiming to grow in maturity, aiming to cease being naive. Any of those things. I mean, these things are repeatedly urged upon us by the Bible, but somehow we don't spot it, and it's not become an objective to almost anyone I've ever met. So the one advantage that you could say, the silver lining of all the mistreatment we get at the hands of the wicked, is that it enables us to grow in wisdom, if we allow it to. But if not, you just waste all those experiences. I had a lot of bad experiences, but I don't think I wasted them. I turned them into book six. And they're going to one day benefit people. But most people waste all those bad experiences. They learn nothing from it. And they're no wiser afterwards than they were before. And that's a criminal waste of experience. God allows you to go through something so you can learn from it, and then you don't learn. You see how tragic that is. But another reason why the wicked are so crafty and how they can anticipate even your intentions is that they get a tip-off. They get a tip-off from a demon. And so they can be far from intelligent. They can be really dim in any academic sense, passing exams or doing maths or writing essays or representing clients. But they know things that they could not know in the natural. And sometimes, you know, I've gone into the office in the morning when I've discovered something about someone and I'm going to tackle them today. And that even as I've walked in to the office, their eyes meet mine and they know. They already know that I've discovered something. They already know I'm onto them. They already know that I've realized what they're doing. How do they know? One way is that they have a feral shrewdness, as I spoke of. Another way is they've been demonically tipped off. They know, because the demon has told them, he's onto you, watch out. They have that advantage. They also, one thing they do, the wicked, is they do an awful lot of snooping and prying in papers and searching around on computers and searching around in other people's files. That's one means by which they get information. So it's feral shrewdness, snooping about, and demonic tip-offs. But by all those means, they're usually well ahead of you, well ahead in terms of knowing what you're doing and why. Let's look, how does the godly discernment and shrewdness that we're to have, how does it differ from feral shrewdness? Well, when the wicked are shrewd, it's as if they're speaking their own native language. It comes naturally to them. But when the wise are shrewd, it's as if you're speaking in a second language. If you want to be wise and become shrewd in this sense, it's almost like that. You've got to learn to do it in French almost. It's not naturally coming to you. You've got to learn it. And shrewdness and wisdom and discernment are learned slowly and with much effort. So godly discernment is not inborn into us. It's not natural. It can only be developed by studying God's word and applying biblical principles and by being taught how to discern by others who have more discernment than we have and by hanging around with them, hanging around with the wise. Thirdly, by hearing the voice of the Holy Spirit and listening to it. And fourthly, from painful experiences of dealing with bad people and bad situations. None of that comes naturally. So godly wisdom is not in line with the standards of this world or the ways of our sinful fleshly nature. It's contrary to that. And so but the wisdom that we get from the Bible or from the Holy Spirit is directly and equally alien to our fleshly nature. So godly values and principles cannot be understood by our carnal nature, by our old man, but they make perfect sense to our new man, to our spirit who is born within us when we become a Christian, when we become a believer. So until we become mature, the wicked have certain advantages over us. So a wicked man listens to his own flesh nature, and he listens to the demons guiding him, whether he does so consciously or not. I mean, most people listen to demons totally unconsciously. Nonetheless, they're heavily guided by them. And so he's listening to his flesh, totally tuned into that, listening to the demons, totally tuned in, and he's listening to the world, he's totally tuned in. So he's got three software packages that are fully integrated. He's listening to all three, and he's compatible. They're compatible with each other because they're all from the same place, and he's well tuned into those. So the flesh, the world, and the devil all speak the same language. They operate on the same principles: selfishness, manipulation, domination, control. But a Christian has got to learn to operate on a totally different basis that is totally unnatural. He's got to operate on the basis of the new man, the spirit. He's got to operate in a godly way. That's totally at variance with what the flesh wants, with what the world wants, with what the devil wants. And so therefore the wicked have a head start. Operating in line with your new nature does not come naturally. It requires effort and persistence, and it's learned slowly. Listening to the voice of the Holy Spirit is like operating on a radio frequency which isn't well tuned in, and it's crackly and quiet, and you have to listen intently and be persistent and try to listen. And therefore you have to keep persisting in these things, in studying the Bible, in listening to the voice of the Holy Spirit, in learning from things that happen to you. And so they have the advantage over you while you're learning, in that learning process. But there is no alternative, because I can't say to you, what you need to do today is just become wise today. Just immediately cease all naivety. Immediately become thoroughly knowledgeable. Immediately become thoroughly discerning. That's cloud cuckoo land. You have to develop these things. There is no other way. But you must set about it. And so, even after we become a Christian, you're not going to hear God's voice all the time correctly. You're going to make mistakes and get things wrong. But you've got to keep pressing forward, taking every thought captive, being renewed in your mind, putting on the new self, as Paul said, changing to operate in accordance with the principles of the new man, not the old man. So a wicked man, he never has to change radio frequencies. He's got a perfectly tuned in radio, listening to the world, the flesh, and the devil. And that's what he listens to crystal clear every day. And you're listening to Radio Holy Spirit, which is crackly and quiet, and it's hard to hear. But the more you listen, the more you learn, the more you know the Bible, the more tuned in that radio becomes. At any rate, the best way forward is to aim to go forward. The best way to achieve those things is to aim to achieve those things. They're not achieved or promoted by randomness or by just hoping you might one day get these things. Okay. Well, I'm going to stop at that point, and we'll pick up in talk 2 in 15 minutes.